Welcome, everyone, to the second lecture this week by Noam Chomsky. And I already introduced him yesterday, so you don't need another introduction today. Let's start off. Noam, welcome.
I'm impressed. I was told that everybody would leave after the first lecture. Well, to recapitulate briefly of the many different ways of in which one can approach language, we've focused on one, selected one particular one, what's been called the generative enterprise, which is concerned with what's been called the basic property of language, namely that each language constructs in the mind an infinite array of structured expressions, each of which has a semantic interpretation that expresses a thought, each of which can be externalized in one or another sensory motor system, typically sound, but not necessarily. As I mentioned, this approach revives a traditional conception, goes back to the 17th century, went as far as early 20th century. The last representative was Otto Jespersen, then forgotten, then revived without knowledge of the tradition. Within the generative enterprise, we also have settled on a particular approach, which is not universal, not required, namely what's called the biolinguistic program, that is regarding the language, a language that a person has as a trait of the person, property of the person, sort of like the person's immune system or the person's visual system. Like other such systems, it is a particular instance of something more general. There's a general mammalian visual system which is innately determined. There's a particular visual system that's the result of interaction with experience, other factors that govern growth, and the same is true of the internal language for clarification called eye language, to make it clear that there's a particular technical notion involved. Eye, fortuitously, stands for internal, individual, and also intentional, with an S, namely, we're interested for the purposes of science in the actual method by which this basic property is expressed, not just any method that happens to yield the same external consequences. So that's the approach. Within this approach, there is a notion at once of what constitutes a genuine explanation. A genuine explanation will have to meet two conditions, the conditions of learnability. The system has to be able to be acquired by an individual, and also evolvability. The innate internal system, the faculty of language, has to have evolved. So if a device is used for description that can't meet those two conditions, we don't have a genuine explanation. We have a description. Descriptions can be very valuable. It's much better to have organized descriptions than chaos, but it's short of genuine explanation. Now, that's a very austere requirement, and until recently, it hasn't even been possible to consider it, but it is the goal to be aimed at by any approach within the sciences or rational inquiry generally. Well, the early work from the 50s distinguished two different aspects of eye language. The term came later, but doesn't matter. The One of them was compositionality, the other was dislocation. For compositionality, the early approach that was adopted was very structured grammar. For dislocation, transformational rules. It was assumed at the time, and in fact for a long time, up to the present, and still is widely believed, that the dislocation is a strange property of language. You wouldn't expect it. It's kind of an imperfection, as it was called. You have to kind of explain it away. Compositionality was taken for granted. As I mentioned, and we'll talk about today, it seems like the opposite is true, which is kind of an interesting result. The phrase structure grammar had two fundamental problems, which were already recognized by the 60s. One is it simply allows way too many rules. That alone disqualifies it. Can't have a system that permits all sorts of impossible rules. The second problem, which was more subtle, is that it conflates three different aspects of internal language, which really should be treated separately. That's become clearer over the years. One is simply compositionality, structure, having structured the core elements of the basic property. The second is linear order, which is not part of the basic property. The third is projection, that is determining what each structured element is, what kind of an element it is. The phrase structure grammar tries to handle all three, and it's become clearer over the years that that's not the right way to proceed. Well, by the late 60s, all of this was becoming partially clear, and this approach turned to what was called X-bar theory to overcome the problems of phrase structure grammar. Well, X-bar theory takes care of some of them. It eliminates the problem of the main problem of far too many rules. In fact, there's basically no rules in an X-bar theoretic approach. So we don't have all these impossible rules hanging around. It also distinguishes order from structure. So there's no order in an X-bar theory. There is still the conflation of projection and structure, which only recently, in the last couple of years, was recognized to be a basic problem, primarily because of the existence of exocentric constructions, which are excluded by X-bar theory, although they're all over the place. As I mentioned, in order to sort of get around this annoyance, special tricks were invented to pick out the right answer intuitively, what is the right answer, but without any particular basis. So there's nothing in X-bar theory that tells you that if you have an NP-VP structure, you should regard it as essentially verbal rather than essentially nominal. It's anything, or as an inflectional element, totally arbitrary. And that, of course, is a very serious problem. It's overcome, I think, by labeling theory, which I'll simply assume you're familiar with. I don't have any time to go into it, but it's an approach which overcomes this problem, doesn't, and it has furthermore the advantage of accounting for when dislocation operations, movement operations, may take place or must take place. And when they have to terminate, does it automatically? But that I'll put aside. The X-bar theory also although this was not recognized at the time, it forces you to have a principles and parameters approach, because there's you have the principle of X-bar theory, but then you have to somehow get the order that's in particular languages. So English and Japanese sort of mirror images at the core. You have to somehow state that separately. Now, there's an interesting, and that led right off within a couple of years to a general principles and parameters approach, which raises interesting questions on its own. Where did the parameters come from? Do they have to evolve? Well, if they have to evolve, then we're very far from genuine explanations. And in fact, the simple case that X-bar theory exposes points to what should be the answer. So for the case of, say, whether you have verb-object or object-verb order, that has, it has to be stated for each particular language. But the answer to it has no effect on the semantic interpretation. So it doesn't feed the conceptual intentional level, which is suggestive. It suggests that whatever the parameters, and if you think about the other parameters that have been proposed, say, null subject parameter or others, they have the property that they do not enter into determining semantic interpretation. So if you pick, say, Richie Kane's proposals about a basic subject-verb-object order versus, say, a basic subject-object-verb order, doesn't make any difference to the semantic interpretation. All of that is very suggestive. If the parameters don't enter into semantic interpretation, we have to ask why they're there altogether. Why don't you just have the, after all, the core part of language is just expressing thoughts, basically, having semantic interpretations. So it begins to look right off as if the parameters should be external to the core part of language. And we'll come back to that, but it looks more and more plausible to me that that's the case. What about their evolution? Well, think again about the head parameter. It didn't evolve. It's just forced by the requirement of having to externalize in a sensory motor system that requires linear order. So it doesn't evolve at all. It's just a requirement. There's a mismatch between the internal system and the sensory motor system, and that mismatch just has to be answered one way or another, but there's no evolution of the parameter. And in fact, the goal ought to be to try to show that all parameters have this property. There's very interesting work on this by the EKS group, Epstein, Kitahara, Seeley, which studying particular array of dialects of Cape Verde Spanish, which they try to show that the differences between the dialects simply reduce to an unstated property of the set of principles. It allows alternative orders of rules, and turns out the several dialects just pick different answers to this. So if that kind of approach can work for all parameters, then the problem of their evolution is overcome. And we go back to having a hope of getting genuine explanations. Well, this is all kind of work in progress. In fact, not even in progress. It's an open problem to be investigated to try to show that for all parameters, all of the options that distinguish language, the goal would be to have two properties. One, to show that they're simply part of externalization. They don't feed the conceptual intentional level, semantic interpretation. And secondly, that they don't evolve at all. They're simply options left open by core grammar, which have to be settled one way or another. So each language picks its way of settling them. Now, that would be the perfect answer if you can find it. Well, X-bar theory partially dealt with these problems. It still left the problem of conflating projection and structure, and it had the huge problem of excluding exocentric constructions, which, as I say, abound, so that's no good. The principles and parameters approach that did develop mainly through the 80s, led to a huge explosion of empirical work on a very wide variety of typologically varied languages. I think more was learned about language in the 80s than in the preceding couple of thousand years. Also, there were conceptual steps forward, but still there was the problem of not being able to reach genuine explanations. Well, by the early 90s, it appeared to a number of people, myself included, that enough had been learned so that it might be possible to tackle the whole general problem of language on more principled grounds. That is, to actually seek genuine explanations, to formulate what was called the strong minimalist thesis, which says that language is basically perfect. What's called approaching universal grammar from below, starting by assuming, let's see how far we can get by assuming a perfect answer that would be a genuine explanation, and how much can we explain this way? Now, that's what's been called the minimalist program. Now, the way to proceed with it is to start with the simplest computational operation, and just let's see how far you can go. Where do you run aground? Well, what you have to do is you have to explain the actual phenomena of language on the basis of the simplest computational operation. That would be the genetic element, plus other factors that, of course, enter into acquisition of language. And there are several such factors. One, of course, is the data with which the child is presented. So we don't all speak Tagalog. It's got to be something in the data that picks out which language we end up with. And it should be the case that the correct theory, when we converge on it, will show that that very limited data suffices to fix the eye language. There's an empirical reason for that. That is that as psycholinguistic evidence studies, child studies have increasingly shown, the basic properties of language are really captured, known quite early with very limited evidence available. There are other factors, sometimes called third factor properties, just general principles of growth and development, which are independent of language, maybe natural laws. That would, for a computational system like language, the natural one to look at is computational efficiency, just assuming that, for the reasons I mentioned last time, that nature seeks the simplest answer. So computational efficiency plus the simplest computational operation plus whatever contribution data makes, that should yield the eye language attained. That's the goal. Now, this program has been called the minimalist program. So where this can be achieved, you do have genuine explanation. If you can explain something simply on the basis of the first and the third factor, namely universal grammar, the simplest computational operation, along with, say, computational efficiency, if anything can be explained in just those two terms, you do have a genuine explanation. You've solved the learnability problem because there's no learning. Okay, that's the optimal solution to the learnability problem. You've also addressed the evolvability problem in the best possible way, if you think it through. The basic property is simply a fact. It's a fact about the faculty of language that it satisfies the basic property. It therefore follows there has to be some computational operation that yields the basic property. And whatever computational operation it is, it's going to incorporate the simplest computational operation, and optimally, nothing else or not much else. So if you can reduce something to the simplest computational operation, you have solved the problem of evolvability, even if you don't know the exact answer as to how this rewiring of the brain took place. You know this must have happened. Okay, so you're free and fair. So whenever you can account for something on the basis of just the first and the third factor, universal grammar and third factor properties like computational efficiency, if you can do that, you certainly have a genuine explanation. You could have more complex genuine explanations if you bring in the effect of the whatever the right theory of determining the eye language from data is. When that factor, the second factor, is introduced, you can have richer kinds of genuine explanations. But the simplest kind will simply reduce to the simplest computational operation plus computational efficiency. Well, notice, of course, that the innate properties, the simplest computational operation, these things may be triggered by data, by evidence, but that's normal for innate properties. I mean, you don't grow, you have to have triggering evidence to get the system to start functioning. So in the case of the visual system, for example, it's known for the mammalian visual system, including humans, that unless you have the right kind of stimulation in very early infancy, in fact, the first couple of weeks, pattern stimulation of certain kinds, then the visual system just doesn't function. It's not learning how to function. It knows how to function, but something's got to set off the system in operation. That's true for innate processes altogether, so presumably true for language as well. So, for example, if a child was raised in isolation with no noises, the faculty of language would collapse, presumably. There's, in fact, even some evidence for that for odd cases, unfortunate cases that have been discovered. Apart from that, it seems that we can at least begin by asking how far can we get to genuine explanation by just looking at first and third factor. Well, so what's the simplest computation possible? Well, the simplest computation, which is found somewhere buried in any computational system, it just takes two objects that have already been constructed and creates a third object from them. In the optimal case, the operation will not modify either of the elements that is operated on. It'll leave them untouched, and it won't add any additional structure. So it just takes two objects, call them X and Y, forms a new object, Z, which doesn't affect X, doesn't affect Y, and doesn't add structure. Now that's basically binary set formation. So the simplest operation, which has been called merge in the last recent years, is simply binary set formation. The question we can ask is, if we can account for something in terms of merge and third factor properties like computational efficiency, we have, in fact, reached a genuine explanation for the first time. Well, if you think about the operation merge, binary set formation, it has two possible cases. So we have X and Y, we're forming the set XY. One case is that X and Y are distinct. Okay. Second case is that one of them, say X, is an element of Y, it's part of Y. A technical term is a term of Y. We define the notion term to mean X is a term of Y if X is a member of Y or it's a member of a term of Y, normal inductive definition, okay, irreflexive. So if one possibility is that X or Y, it doesn't matter, is a term of Y, the other possibility is that they're distinct. There's a third imaginable case, namely that they overlap. But if you think about the process of construction of binary sets, you can't have that case. So that case we can rule out. So we have basically two options. The names that are used for them are external merge for two distinct elements, and internal merge where one is part of the other. The linguistic analogs would be, for example, forming read books from read and books. That's external merge. Internal merge would be forming what did you see from you saw what. Notice what you actually form is what you saw what. Okay, you take what, merge it to you saw what, and you get what you saw what. Okay, that's critically important. That's internal merge. Internal merge is dislocation. But dislocation is now a strange word because you're actually keeping the original element. Okay, that's internal merge. External merge just takes two separate things and brings them together. Notice that these two are one operation, merge. They're not two different operations. These are just the two possible cases of the single operation. There's a lot of confusion about this in the literature, so you really want to be careful about it. Well, just to be clear, the minimalist program is a program. It's not a theory, right? There's been a lot of, you read in the literature, discussions of whether the minimalist program is true or has it been refuted, or that's meaningless. It's a program of research that asks, how far can we get towards genuine explanation? Okay, that's the program. As I mentioned last time, by now it has some, in recent, very recent years, some independent motivation from what's very recently been discovered about the conditions of evolution of the language faculty. To repeat quickly, it's now been established by genomic evidence that the language faculty was established prior, roughly at the time of the appearance of anatomically modern humans. And there's no evidence for symbolic activity before that. So we have an indication, not a proof, but an indication that probably what happened is very simple. And it apparently hasn't changed since the language faculty is shared, among the earliest separating groups, but in fact, as far as we know, among all human groups. So we have independent reason to believe that it's that the program is a plausible program. It's likely that the right answer to what the language faculty is will in fact be something like the simplest computational operation. Well, how far can we get on this? It seems to me that in the last couple of years there have been pretty substantial achievements which give an indication of how far we might be able to go. One achievement is cases where you have reached genuine explanation, I mean. One is simply the unification of the two fundamental properties of language that were recognized back in the 50s, composition and dislocation. If they can both be unified in merge, I think the first person to point this out was Hisa Kitahara, who's sitting over there. If you can bring these together, it's a pretty substantial achievement. These were always thought to be two totally separate parts of language, but maybe they're just the same operation, in fact, the simplest operation. So maybe the null hypothesis, the perfect case, is that you have both dislocation and composition. Actually, you can push that a little farther. If you think about the two cases of merge, internal and external, which one is the more primitive, the simplest, the one that involves least computation? Actually, internal merge. If you think of external merge, requires search. you want to bring two things together that are distinct. You have to search all the available possibilities. Well, what are those? First of all, it's the entire lexicon. Say maybe 50,000 items for a normal knowledge, plus anything that's already been constructed. This is a recursive procedure, so you're constructing things along the way, and any of them can be accessed for further operations. So external merge involves a huge search procedure. Internal merge, in contrast, involves almost no search at all. You're just looking at a particular structure. You're taking a look at its terms. That's it. So internal merge is by far the more primitive operation. External merge is much more complex, which is an interesting conclusion because the opposite has always been assumed. It's always been assumed that compositionality is the obvious case. We don't have to explain that. The dislocation is the complicated case, the imperfection, the strange property of language. It turns out when you think it through that the opposite's the case. Internal merge, dislocation, is the simplest case. What you have to ask is, why do we have external merge at all? Why not just keep to the simplest case? Well, think about that for a minute. I'll come back to it in a second. But that's what you discover when you begin to think about the nature of the operations. Incidentally, there are some independent reasons for this, not proofs, but suggestive. If you think about internal merge alone, so imagine the simplest case. You have a lexicon of one element, and we have the operation internal merge. I could write this down, but it's simple enough so you can figure it out in your heads. So we have one element. Let's just give it the name zero, okay? We internally merge zero with itself. That gives us the set zero, zero, which is just the set zero, okay? So we've now constructed a new element, the set zero, which we call one. Then we apply internal merge again. We take the term of the set zero, that's zero. We merge it with the set zero. We now have a new element, consists of two elements, zero and the set containing zero. We call that one two, and we just keep going. We've created the successor function. And in fact, if you think about it a little more, we've also created addition, because if you take one of the longer terms and you merge that, you're essentially getting addition. Multiplication is just repeated addition, unbounded repeated addition. So we basically have the foundations of arithmetic just from internal merge. That raises a very interesting question. There is a question that very much troubled Charles Darwin and the co-founder of evolutionary theory, Alfred Russel Wallace, who were in contact. They were both concerned with what appeared to be a serious contradiction to the theory of natural selection, namely the fact that all human beings understand arithmetic. If you think about it, arithmetic has never been used in human evolution, except in a very tiny period tacked on at the very end. But for almost the entire history of human beings, nobody bothered with arithmetic. You might have small numbers, you might have what's called numerosity, knowing that 80 things is more than 60 things. But that's quite different from arithmetic, knowing that the numbers can go on forever, knowing what the computations are of, say, addition and multiplication. So where did this come from? Darwin and Wallace simply assumed that all humans have it. By now, there's pretty good evidence that they're right, that it's you find indigenous tribes that have no number words beyond maybe 1, 2, and 3, and do handle numerosity. It turns out that as soon as they're inserted into, say, market societies, they immediately compute freely. They have the entire knowledge. And in fact, on conceptual grounds, we know that this must be the case, because there's no way to learn it. There's no possible way to learn that the numbers go on forever. You can't have evidence for that. But every child just knows it, you know. So the problem is, where did it come from? Since it was not selected and it's universal, looks like it contradicts the fundamental ideas of the theory of evolution. Well, a possible answer to this is that it's just an offshoot of the language faculty. The language faculty did emerge. It's here, we're using it, so it's around. The language faculty, at the very least, in its simplest case, gives you arithmetic. So it's quite possible that the reason everyone knows arithmetic is just we've got the language faculty. So therefore, we have the simplest case of it. Now, on the surface, it looks as if there's counter evidence, which has been brought up quite often, namely dissociations, kind of things that Susan Curtis discusses. There are dissociations between arithmetical competence and linguistic competence. So there are people who have a perfect language faculty and can't do arithmetic, and conversely. However, it's not clear that that's a counter argument for reasons that were pointed out a couple of years ago by Luigi Rizzi, a great linguist who most of us know. He pointed out that the tests for dissociation are testing performance. They're testing what people use, not the internal knowledge. So as, for example, there are also dissociations between reading and language competence. There are people who can have normal language competence but can't read, conversely. Now, it can't be that there's a separate reading faculty. That's impossible. So, in fact, what it shows is just that the tests are studying the utilization of the competence. They're not testing the competence itself. So it may very well turn out that this is the answer to the Darwin-Wallace problem, a deep problem of evolutionary theory. Going beyond, there's other very suggestive evidence. Marvin Minsky, one of the founders of artificial intelligence, a very good mathematician, about a couple decades ago, actually, in the 60s, he and one of his students experimented with the simplest Turing machines. The ones that Turing machine is just, you know, an abstract computer, basically. The ones that have the smallest number of states and the smallest number of symbols. And they just asked the question, what happens if you just let these things run free? And they got an interesting result. Most of them crash. They either get into infinite loops or they just terminate. Of the ones that didn't crash, they gave the successor function, which suggests strongly. And then Marvin went on to draw the plausible conclusion. He said, probably nature in the course of evolution will pick the simplest thing, so it'll pick the successor function. So he was thinking of things like extraterrestrial intelligence. He said, we can expect that if you ever find anything like that, it'll be based on the successor function, because that's the one that's the simplest one. Well, that's internal merge. So from quite a number of points of view, we have a conclusion that dislocation is probably the primitive element of language. Composition is the one that has to be explained. So why do we have external merge altogether? Well, if you think about, suppose we didn't have external merge, what would language look like? Actually, it'd be nothing but the successor function, because that's all that internal merge can produce, successor function plus addition. So if you had, say 10 elements in the lexicon instead of one, and you used only internal merge, what you would get is 10 instances of the successor function, nothing else. But the language has other properties. For example, it has argument structure, theta theory. It has things like agent, patient, and so on. Well, you can't get that from internal merge. you're required to have external merge to develop the structures which will yield argument structure, theta structure. So an empirical property of language, namely that it has argument structure, forces you to use this more complex operation of external merge. Another reason for it is, again, the existence of exocentric constructions, like, say, subject-predicate. You can't get those by internal merge, of course. So there's just empirical reasons that force language to include the more complex operation of external merge. Notice that this turns everything that's been believed in the generative enterprise and the tradition, turns it on its head. That's exactly the opposite of what's been assumed. The basic operation is dislocation, internal merge, arithmetic, essentially. Then, because of special properties of language, like argument structure, exocentric constructions, you're just compelled to use also the more complex case of external merge. But again, notice that these are both the same operation. Just two cases of the same operation, one more primitive than the other. You're forced to use also the less primitive one, compositionality, because of properties of language. Well, notice again that in the case of internal merge, you not only get dislocation, but you have several copies of the element that has been dislocated. Those of you who know how this works know that you can have a great many copies. You can have successive cyclic dislocation, which leaves a copy in every position with consequences for externalization and interpretation. Well, that's very important because of a phenomenon known in the linguistic literature as reconstruction. Namely, the dislocated element is actually interpreted in the position from which it came, and even intermediate positions. So standard examples are things like the sentences, it is his mother that every boy admires. So meaning every boy admires his mother. It is his mother that admires every boy. Doesn't work. Every does not range over the variable his. And the reason, if you think about it, is that the copy, what's reaching the mind, actually has the phrase his mother in the position in which quantification works. Every boy admires his mother is actually reaching the mind, although not the ear. And there are many more complex interpretations, examples of this. There's no time, so I won't go through it, but if those of you familiar with the literature know, you get quite complex, intricate examples of the phenomenon of reconstruction. Now, in a lot of the literature, the modern literature, there is an operation of reconstruction that somehow takes the kind of structurally highest element and reinterprets it back in the initial position. But that's unnecessary because that comes automatically. It's just there. Okay, so what reaches the mind is the entire, what's called the chain of elements, all of the elements that have been dislocated, but it doesn't reach the ear. What reaches the ear is just, it cuts out all but one of them. Actually, that's interestingly, it's not entirely correct. I'll come back to it in a minute. But put that aside for a minute. I'll return to it in 1 second. And notice that when you look at these cases, you have a strengthening of the conclusion that was already suggested by X-bar theory, namely that the core language, the system that just reaches the mind, that gives semantic interpretations, pays no attention to the way the thing appears on the surface, okay? It just asks what happens on the internal operations. Things may appear on the surface like linear order or missing the copy, but the mind doesn't care because it's only paying attention to the internal operation. And that raises the question, why does linear order even exist? Why do you have it? Well, trivial answer to that. The sensory motor system requires it partially. If you use a different sensory motor system for externalization, like sign language, it doesn't have strictly linear order. The reason is visual space provides options that acoustic production does not have. You have to speak one thing after another. But if you have visual space, you can use positions in it to convey the meaning. And that's, in fact, done in sign language. So anaphora in sign language works by picking a point in space and referring back to it, which you can't do in spoken language. You can also have simultaneous operations in sign language, like raising your eyebrows while you're signing, which turns something into a question. Can't do that in spoken language. So the nature of the, in general, the nature of the sensory motor system is determining properties of language in the broad sense, which are not part of core language at all. They just reflect the characteristics of the sensory motor system. Well, now there's something that came up in the discussion last time. I'll repeat it. The sensory motor systems have nothing at all to do with language, okay? These were in place long before, in fact, millions of years before the language ever evolved. So the time when language evolved, maybe roughly a couple hundred thousand years ago, the sensory motor systems were in place, independent of language. They haven't changed with the usage of language. They're still what they were, you know, the origins of Homo sapiens, with the most extremely minor variations. There's no indication of any adaptation of sensory motor systems to language. So the early Homo sapiens who developed this internal system by whatever means they did, some rewiring of the brain, which gave the simplest computational operation, they had the task of getting this stuff out somehow, and they had to use the sensory motor systems that are around, as we do, as every infant does, and the sensory motor system imposes conditions, but those are not linguistic conditions. They're not, strictly speaking, part of language, from which we can conclude, it's a contentious claim, as Hilda pointed out last time, but it looks from this kind of argument as though things like linear order or elimination of the copy just don't have anything to do with language. They're part of their conditions imposed by the mode of externalization, which is language independent. And as I mentioned last time, this has the paradoxical conclusion that just about everything that's been studied in linguistics for the last 2,500 years is not language. It's the study of some amalgam of language and sensory motor systems. But if we want to really think it through, the internal language, the thing that's computing away and giving you semantic interpretations, that doesn't have any of these things. It doesn't have operations of reconstruction, doesn't have linear order, just operating along, giving you, producing thoughts in your mind, which you can then try to externalize somehow. Well, in fact, if you think about it, that's even true of what's called inner speech. So almost all the time, say 24 hours a day, you're basically talking to yourself. You can't stop. It takes a tremendous act of will to keep you from talking to yourself. But if you think about inner speech, it's externalized speech. You're not, for example, it has linear order, or you can think about two sentences you just produced in your mind, and you can ask, do they rhyme? Are they the same length? Do they have copies, and so on? Answer is they don't. So what we call inner speech is very superficial. It's not what's going on in the mind. All of this has a lot of implications for the study of consciousness and preconscious mental operations. Almost everything that's involved in language seems to be inaccessible to consciousness. It's prior to whatever reaches consciousness, even in inner speech. A lot of implications to this which are worth thinking through. Well, a conclusion that kind of begins to appear on the horizon is that core language, the internal computations yielding linguistically articulated thoughts, a core language could be universal. It's possible that it's just common to the species. It's part of the faculty of language, you know, which would solve the learnability problem, because nothing would be learned if that's true. And it would solve the evolvability problem insofar as you can reduce the operations to the simplest computations. Okay, so that's a kind of a goal that you can see formulating itself on the horizon, something to strive at in research. You would also anticipate, if this is correct, that the variety of languages is just a surface phenomenon. It's not really a fact about language. I mentioned last time that in the structuralist behavioralist period, it was assumed almost as a dogma that languages can differ from one another pretty much arbitrarily, and that each one has to be studied without any bias, any preconceptions. That was what was called the Boasian doctrine. If this is correct, that's just completely false. There's only maybe even just one language, and a lot of variation that comes from mapping it into externalization systems. You would expect the same to be true of the complexity of language. Relating two independent systems is a complex affair, so you could naturally expect the complexity of language to reside there. Also, just the fact that languages change very fast. In fact, every generation there's language change, but could be that this is just externalization. Anyway, those are goals to be thinking about, kind of coming into view when you just think about the nature of the problem. Well, under externalization, as mentioned before, the mind hears every case, but the ear only hears one case. Okay, so when you say, what did John eat for, let's say it is his mother that every student admires, you don't hear, it is his mother that every student admires his mother. That's hitting the ear, so you know how to interpret it, but it's the mind, but it's not hitting the ear. And that's in general true. Actually, there's some very interesting qualifications to this. There's an interesting study it's known that in some languages, the initial position that you don't hear in this location actually has some kind of a phonetic mark, some sort of a sound that indicates I was here, you know. There's a study by a Vietnamese linguist, Thuy Trinh, who goes into this in some detail and relates it to prosodic properties of the language, which pretty well determine when this is the case. More intricate for those of you who know this stuff, in successive cyclic movement, when you have successive dislocation to higher and higher positions, there are in many languages, strange residues along the way. That's true at both of what are called phases, CP level and the V star P level. You get, in some languages, traces that something went through here. So there's some indication in some languages in the externalization that there was something there, but overwhelmingly, you just don't hear anything. you hear one case, typically the structurally highest case. So there are, although what are called in situ languages, like say Chinese, Japanese, it's you hear it in the base generated place, the place where it started from. Actually, that's true in languages like English too. So you have in situ constructions in English and similar languages in very special circumstances, which are interesting. But overwhelmingly, languages vary this way. So the question that arises is, why don't you pronounce everything? Why bother deleting a lot of them? Well, here we turn to a third factor property, computational efficiency. Suppose you were to pronounce all of them. Notice that the things that you could pronounce, I gave a simple example, what did you eat? But instead of what, it could be of arbitrary complexity. So, you know, which book that appeared in 1690 and then was destroyed, did you read, let's say. If you repeat that, you've got a lot of computation going on, mental computation to set the stage for phonetic articulation and then motor control to articulate the whole thing. So you have massive reduction in complexity if you just don't pronounce these things, okay? So computational efficiency compels the deletion of the copies. You can't delete them all, of course, or else there's no indication that the operation ever took place. So you have to leave one at least, typically the structurally highest one. The rest you delete. Well, that's fine from the point of view of meeting the condition of computational efficiency, but it has a consequence for language use, causes problems for perception, serious problems, in fact. Those of you who've worked on mechanical parsing programs know that one of the toughest problems is what's called filler gap problems. You hear a sentence which begins with which book, then comes the whole sentence, and you have to find the place where which book is interpreted, but there's nothing there. You know? That's called a filler gap problem. These can be pretty tricky. I mean, it's simple in the case that I mentioned, but if you think through more complex cases, it can become quite intricate. So the fact that we have the following strange situation, computational efficiency is forcing a communicative inefficiency, okay? Computational efficiency is forcing parsing problems, perception problems, communication problems. What does that suggest? It suggests that the way language evolved and is designed, it just doesn't care about efficiency of use. It's of no interest. It just cares about efficiency of computation. Now, there's a lot of evidence for this, and many things that are quite familiar to us and nobody bothered thinking about. But take things like structural ambiguity. You know, examples like flying planes can be dangerous, which can mean either the act of flying planes can be dangerous or planes that fly can be dangerous. There's lots of structural ambiguity in language. Now, where does it come from? Well, if you look at the cases, it comes from just allowing the rules to run freely and not caring whether it causes perception problems or not. But all structural ambiguity problems are perception problems. You have to figure them out. Take what are called garden path sentences, discovered by Tom Bever about 50 years ago. Sentences like, the horse raced past the barn, fell. When you present this to people, they are confused. What's fell doing there? You know, the horse raced past the barn is a sentence. It's called a garden path sentence. It leads you down the garden path. But if you think about it, it's a perfectly grammatical sentence. It could be the horse that somebody raced past the barn fell, okay? Well, these are all over the place. In fact, incidentally, if you run the Google parser on them, you know, the one you can pick off the internet crashes all the time on these. But but they're normal parts of language. And again, these are just cases where the rules run free, and they don't care whether it causes problems or not. Actually, the most interesting case, too complicated to go into, but many of you are familiar with it, is islands, things where you just can't extract. You can think them, but you can't produce them. The cases of islands that are understood, there's a lot of problems with them, all turned out to be cases where you have computational efficiency forcing the island, compelling a paraphrase, often a complex paraphrase, to somehow get around it. Well, the general conclusion seems to be that as far as I know, whenever there's a conflict between computational efficiency and communicative efficiency, computational efficiency wins. The language just doesn't care about communicative efficiency. That also has a consequence. There is a very widely held doctrine, almost a dogma, that somehow the function of language, you know, how it evolved, its basic design and so on, is as a system of communication. And apparently that's not the case. Apparently language just doesn't care about communication. Of course, it's used for communication, it's very useful, but that just seems to be something on the side. Probably the background for this doctrine is, first of all, that we do use language for communication all the time, so on the surface that's what you see, and also a kind of a belief going back to early Darwinian notions that anything that evolved had to go by small steps from earlier things. So somehow language should have evolved from animal communication systems. But it seems to be just entirely false. Language seems to have come from something totally different, having nothing to do with communicative systems. Well, a lot to say about this, but time is running out, I think. I've lost the track of time. What am I?
Three o'clock.
Okay. Well, let me just go on a little bit because there's a lot I want to get to. There are other genuine explanations, some of them pretty striking for non-trivial properties. The most interesting one of all, I think, is what's called structure dependence. It's a strange property of language, puzzling property noticed years ago, that the operations of language simply don't seem to pay attention to linear order. They only pay attention to structural relations. So standard example in the literature is things like the man who is tall is happy. If you turn that into a question, it becomes, is the man who is tall happy? Not, is the man who tall is happy? Okay, that's obvious. Everybody knows that. Well, as soon as generative grammar began, the question arose, why? Why don't you use the simple computational operation of picking the first occurrence of the auxiliary and putting it in front? It's a much simpler operation than the one that's used. The one that's used, in fact, picks the structurally closest one. So if you draw the tree, the structure of this, you see that structurally the one that's picked is the one that's used. Similar, take a sentence, can animals that fly swim? We understand that to mean can they swim, not fly. So it doesn't mean, I have to read it because it's hard to work out. Is it the case that animals that can fly also swim? Why doesn't it mean that? It's perfectly fine meaning. So why doesn't the sentence mean that? That's what it would mean if you picked the first occurrence of can and moved it or interpreted it. But it's not a mistake that anybody can possibly make, any child makes, let's say. In fact, it's by now known that by about 30 months old, infants already are operating with structure dependence. It's something that's just automatic. You have essentially no evidence for it. And this is true for constructions in all languages, as far as anybody knows. Well, all of these are things we take for granted, but the usual question arises, why? Why? It's particularly puzzling because for two reasons. For one thing, we avoid what looks like the computationally simple operation, linear order. That's trivial. Pick the first thing is trivial. We avoid that. We use what looks like a much more complex operation. A second reason it's puzzling is we ignore everything we hear. What we hear is linear order. We don't hear structure. That's something the mind constructs internally. So we ignore everything we hear. We ignore what looks like the simplest operation, and we do it universally. And this is true for cases, examples like, is the man who is tall happy, have been a little misleading. They have led cognitive scientists to believe that maybe you could learn this, because you could have something, you have data for it. And there's huge literature trying to show that one way or another you might acquire this. But there's plenty of cases where the evidence is just zero, total zero. So take, for example, the sentence, the guy who fixed the car carefully packed his tools. It's ambiguous. He can fix the car carefully or carefully pack his tools. If carefully appears in front, carefully the guy who fixed the car packed his tools, it's unambiguous. You unambiguously pick the more remote verb, not the closest verb. Evidence for that is zero. There's no way you can learn that by deep learning of the Wall Street Journal corpus or something. But this is universal in language. So there is a puzzle, and there's, in fact, an answer. The answer is language is based on the simplest computational operation, namely merge, which has no order, okay? So the option of using linear order just isn't there in the internal core language. So here's a situation where there's no learning necessary because that's just innate. There's no evolvability problem because it's the simplest computational operation. So you have a genuine explanation of quite a deep property of language, strange property of language, structure dependence, no linear order. There happens to be confirming evidence from other sources in this case. There are neurolinguistic studies initiated by a linguist, the linguist here know, Andrea Moro, a group in Milan brain scientists who devised the obvious study. They took two groups of subjects, each of which was presented with a invented nonsense language. One of the languages was modeled on a real language that they didn't know. The second used rules that violate universal grammar, like linear order. So for example, in the second language, the invented one, the negation, it would be, say, the third word in a sentence, okay, which is very trivial to compute. In the one modeled on a real language, negation was whatever negation is, which is pretty complicated when you look at it. Well, what they found is that the subjects who were presented with the invented language modeled on a real language handled it with activation in the normal language areas of the brain, mostly Broca's area. In the case of the subjects presented with the language, say, in which negation was the third element, they didn't get Broca's area activation. They got diffuse activation over the brain, which indicates it's just being treated as a puzzle, you know, it's not a language problem. Similar evidence was presented by a study, again, the linguist known, Neil Smith and Ianti Zimpli, who work with a particular subject who's has very low cognitive capacities, extremely low, but has remarkable language capacities, picks up languages like a sponge, basically. And when they presented him, Chris, they call him, with the invented language based on a real language, learned it very quickly, when they presented him with the one that has, say, negation in the third position, he couldn't handle it at all. It's a puzzle. He can't deal with puzzles. So here's a very striking case, a rare case, where we have the optimal explanation for something, perfect explanation, genuine explanation, fundamental property of language. We have confirming evidence from all the other relevant sources, language acquisition, it's known right away, neurolinguistics, you get the right kind of brain activation, psycholinguistics, you get dissociations. You couldn't ask for a better result. Now, here's a very curious fact about the field of cognitive science altogether. There's a huge literature, in fact, one of the major topics in computational cognitive science is trying to show how this could be learned somehow from data. How it could be learned without what's called inductive bias for structure. Now, you think of if you look at this literature, first of all, the methods that are proposed, if they're at all clear enough to investigate, they all, of course, fail. But a more important fact is it wouldn't matter if they succeeded. So suppose that you could say, take the Wall Street Journal corpus and use some deep learning method and figure out from it that speakers of English use the structural rule. The significance of that would be absolutely zero, because it's asking the wrong question. The question is, why is this the case? In fact, why is it the case for every construction in every language? So even if inconceivably you could show how it could be learned, wouldn't matter, okay? It's totally irrelevant. It's the wrong question. What about the inductive bias? There's no inductive bias. It's just the simplest explanation. So it's as if this entire effort, which those of you who know the literature will know that this is a huge part of computational cognitive science, but the entire effort is an effort to try to disprove the null hypothesis. Now, if you think about it, things like that just don't happen in the sciences. It's just not the kind of thing you undertake. Like if there's a perfect solution for something, you don't try to find some complicated way in which you could have gotten it some other way. It doesn't make any sense. It raises serious questions about the nature of the field. It's a strange departure from sciences. There are other successes, but starting next time, I want to turn to something else, problems with merge, the reasons, places where it really doesn't work, and what we can do about this. Okay.